Welcome to the Political Cesspool, known worldwide as the South's foremost populist radio program. And here to guide you through the murky waters of the political cesspool is your host, James Edwards.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. Third and final hour of tonight's live installment of the Political Cesspool. I am, in fact, your host, James Edwards, joined in studio this evening by my comrade and colleague, co-host, Bill Rowland. It's Saturday evening, March 21st. We're red hot and rolling live and on the air, AM 1380 WLRM in Memphis, and going out to our affiliates across the country on the Liberty News Radio Network, also via satellite internet. If there's a way you can hear us, we are coming to you in that way. And Bill, as you know, we have a very, very special guest, a man who was just here in Memphis for a private reception last evening that was sponsored in part by this radio program. I'd like for you to make his introduction.
Of course, our guest, our final guest tonight, is an old friend of the political cesspool, a man who's been on the show many times and gives both poignant, intelligent, and very strong commentary on the state of our race and the state of our people. We'd like to welcome to the show once again Sam Dixon, Esquire of Atlanta. Sam, welcome to the show. I understand that you had a very successful meeting in Memphis with some of our local people, and we're pushing forward with hope for our people. But I think the topic tonight is hope and change, and I'm sure that living in Atlanta, that diverse, rich city, multicultural rainbow city, that hope and change has certainly come to an Atlanta, and the rainbow is over the entire metropolis, isn't it?
Yes. I was speaking before this program began. And first of all, hello, James. Hello, Roland. Hello, everybody on the network. I was glad to be in Memphis last night, and met some very fine people. It's interesting that liberals never learn. They've been predicting things and laying the law down now for generations, and everything they've said has failed, but they still feel that they are almost infallible and that they have the answer to everybody's problems. I was reading the New York Times yesterday an article about glimmers of hope in Zimbabwe, that they hope that the coalition government there can somehow tame Mugabe and bring some sort of betterment to that society, and they went into the background of the hunger, how many people are starving and hungry, and it was a long article. It filled almost an entire page, if you put it all on one page. And it's interesting that I never saw any mention of something called white farmers. I never saw any mention of white farmers and the genocidal attacks upon them by the black population of Zimbabwe. And maybe that genocidal attack upon the 5,000 white people that were feeding them, you'd think a journalist from the stature of the New York Times might have mentioned this, but it probably would have been very stressful and wounding to the intellectual liberal readership to be reminded of something that would be such a terrible social faux pas as to mention genocidal attacks upon the whites and the direct connection between that and starvation in Zimbabwe. And I couldn't help but remember, you know, for those of us who are old, that we remember, it seems like yesterday, that the American media and the New York Times were full of triumphant accounts that we had finally broken down that old devil racism, and the hope was on its way, and there was change you could believe in coming to Rhodesia, and not merely the change of the name, but we have the first African president of what used to be Rhodesia. And, of course, this has failed totally and utterly. And in any sane society, the people like the New York Times editorial board and Henry Kissinger and the liberal Republicans and the liberal Democrats and the fake conservatives and the fake liberals who put this policy together of turning Rhodesia into Zimbabwe, these people would have no credibility. They would come and admit, we were totally wrong. We were puffed, not only were we wrong, we were puffed up and arrogant, and now we are deservedly made to look utterly ridiculous. And as decent people, we acknowledge our error, we admit we were wrong, and we just owe it to society to retire and walk off the stage and cease botching the world. But then liberals are not like that. So they just go right on from one failure to another, and they never take stock of the fact that their program is hopeless. It's totally hopelessly wrong and disproven, which shows that they and we, because they rule over us, are in the grips of an ideology, and that facts don't matter. They're in their own world, imprisoned in their own ideology, and they can never face reality or facts or the results of their failed social experiments.
Well, Sam, you talked about this last night and touched on the fact that we we have a ruling elite that are either psychopathic or sociopathic, and certainly we are trying to replay the same broken record, just carrying it over from Rhodesia and South Africa to America. But you also made mention in your remarks last night something that I'd like to touch on this evening on the broadcast about the failed leadership of our own people, of our own movement, how we so often want to fall back on the ain't it awful strategy. Tell the audience what you mean by that.
Most of the media of dissident American groups is full of reports of terrible incidents of murders and rapes and devastated inner cities, one thing after another, Bernie Madoff scandal, and things like this. And it's been like this all my life. When I was just a teenager and first started going to Goldwater meetings in 1963, this was the standard fare. And the idea behind it, I think, has been that if you could just make people see the extent of minority criminality and these terrible things that have happened, that people will be led to do something. And the fact of the matter is that it doesn't work this way. What happens is that eventually people just get demoralized and depressed from hearing this stuff, and they give up, and they go inactive, and they just go into their own world. And without offering people solutions and drawing conclusions and telling them very clearly what the conclusions are that should be drawn by logical, thoughtful people from these facts, they're not going to do it on their own. They've got to be offered a solution, an analysis and a solution. And the American, I hate the word right, because we're not either left or right. You know, we're centered in our own people, without regard to ideological abstractions. But we've got to offer people solutions. And I think the solution that we should offer is that we should have a state, a nation, for our own people on this continent, and our ancestral peoples in Europe should have their own states where they can enjoy the same benefits that the Jewish people have in Israel. And people who would say that the idea of a white national state is an extremist idea or is impractical, if these people are logically consistent, then certainly the idea of Israel is far more an extremist idea and far more impractical. There are 200 million white Christian Americans in this country and 400 or so million of them in Europe. We've all had countries of our own within living memory, and when you look at Israel, this is a country that was recreated after almost 2,000 years in a language, a dead language revived. It has a tiny 6 million person population and is situated as a Jewish island in the middle of an extremely angry and understandably infuriated Arab Sea. Those problems don't exist in terms of creating an America for Americans or a France for Frenchmen. We're not going back 2,000 years to recreate something. We're not requiring the displacement of the large numbers of people in terms of percentages that the creation of Israel required. And there's space in our continent to give the minorities their own nations and to free them from what they say has been a terrible experience of being associated with racist bigots like white people.
Well,
and,
Sam...
It just seems to me that this is a very modest and simple and workable proposal. And it's a solution that we ought to give people.
I think what you're saying here, and quite eloquently so, is that which we're advocating, that which we at least want to have considered, is far less, quote-unquote, extremist than the Zionist line, which everyone thinks is just great and perfectly sensible.
Yes,
and
anyone who even questions Israel's right to exist is shouted down Hillary Clinton, as our Secretary of State, says that it's also a condition of negotiations, that you have to start by recognizing the right of the Jewish people to a racially exclusive state. And you know, with us, though, it's an immediate thing that your idea is simple and extreme, and you're not entitled to the country.
Sam, we're going to pick up right where you're leaving off, and the political cesspool returns on the Liberty News Radio Network right after these words from our sponsors.
Don't go away. The political cesspool guys will be back right after these messages.
Don't let me be misunderstood.
Please understand me, baby.
Don't let me be misunderstood.
Don't misunderstand me, baby.
Jump in the political cesspool with James and the gang. Call us tonight at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the political cesspool, James Edwards.
Welcome back to the show, everybody. You know, it just dawned on me, this being the debut for our program on this brand new network, that when we debuted on Republic Broadcasting back 7 months ago, the guests on that inaugural show were Michael Andrew Grissom, Joe McCutcheon, Ted Pike, and Sam Dixon. And tonight the guests are Ted Pike and Sam Dixon. Sam, there's something about you and debut shows that is almost magnetic.
Oh, I don't know about that. I think maybe I'm getting tired. Maybe you need to find something new. I don't know.
No, I don't think so. In fact, if I had my way, I would abuse our friendship by having you on much more often. But continuing on this evening, nevertheless, Sam, you have written that, and it's certainly true, that you've toiled in the vineyards of American racial nationalism for a great many years. We've been long on problems and short on solutions. You've also talked in this modest proposal of yours that we're discussing tonight that we have got to begin to present to our people concrete and workable solutions. And long has been the question, when will our people wake up? How much punishment are we going to have to take before we come full circle and take back that which has been taken from us? Sam, I guess if you knew the answer, if you knew how you could reverse it, it would have been a solution you would have employed a long time ago. But as we talked about last night, a lot of folks have said time and time again that it's going to take a great economic crisis before we have a chance to rise up and rise to the occasion. Well, we're certainly in the economic crisis. A lot of people are suffering. Have you seen, now that we have a black president, have you seen any signs whatsoever that folks are beginning to have their fill of it, Sam?
Well, the problem in determining whether what people are thinking is that everybody, left and right, and black and white or whatever, we tend to talk to people who agree with us. So naturally, people that share our views are concerned. I don't have any way of really seeing what the average person is thinking, how they're reacting. I do think that they seem so overwhelmed with their personal tragedies of their economic plight that I don't know how much thought they're giving to the overall political situation or racial situation.
Well, that's fair enough, because it's hard to say. I mean, certainly within the circles we run, it's almost a unanimous consent that we're right about everything. And I certainly believe that we're right, and for a number of reasons. History proves us right on many of the things we advocate on this program. But you were talking earlier before the break about how normal it is for the Jews to have the Zionist line in Israel, but yet here, if a person such as yourself or me or Bill or any of the hundreds of thousands of people who have listened to this program would cite a similar line for European Americans, they would be shouted down, if not fined, or potentially imprisoned. Are there any set of circumstances, Sam, that we haven't experienced yet where you could see the Zionist line being applied for white people here in this country? What circumstances would have to happen before you could say, okay, this is going to be more than just talk. It's going to be more than just academic essays being written. This is something that's going to come into play here.
Well, I think there has to be a tremendous psychological change in our people. The psychological is the key to almost anything. And when you look at the psychology of our people, the amazing thing, as you were just saying, is that they have put up with so much. They have put up with really serious problems. The economic problem right now is like a shoe; it's pinching their feet. But they're just on a day-to-day basis. Driving into Memphis last night, I was stalled in the rush hour traffic of people trying to go home from Memphis, and just terribly snarled and congested streets and expressways. All of this has been it's a price they pay for going along with liberal ideologies and with anti-white racist ideologies. There's no reason why we shouldn't be able to live in cities the way people did three generations ago, the way people in Europe, some areas of Europe, can still do. The cost that this imposes on tens of millions of white Americans all over the country every day, the stress of being at the wheel in Atlanta for an hour driving home to Alpharetta. Because you can't live in the cities, because your children can't go to schools in the cities that where your taxpayers pay money pays for these schools. Just the traffic cost. I estimate that the time lost by commuters in Atlanta every day is the equivalent to murdering a considerable number of people. If you figure, you've got hundreds of thousands of people losing several hours a day, very quickly you run up enough hours to create a whole lifetime. And this is just the cost day after day, not counting the cost of wear and tear on the car, of gasoline, the financial out-of-pocket costs, the greater rate of accidents and injuries and all of this. And that's just one of many, many ways that this thing has pressed down upon our people like a crown of thorns for decades now. The strategy has always been every man for himself, and that's the strategy. It's the strategy of our so-called leadership, which as you were saying, is largely in every area of our life, is selective for sociopathic people who feel no loyalty to their people. Every man for himself. Get yourself home in the suburb. Don't keep your head down. Don't say anything. Take it like a man. Don't quarrel about the diversity program. Be willing to accept the loss of the promotion. Be willing to accept your son not getting a scholarship to college despite outscoring the minority affirmative action scholarship recipient. Just keep working on your own and try to make it on your own. And that's not going to work. It's not working now. But at some point, people have to realize that. And they have to change psychologically. And they have to become willing to take risks. And to take the blows. I mean, it's like when you were in high school, unless you were willing to be a coward and to be bullied by the other kids, virtually every kid, at least in the South, you had to be willing to get into a certain number of fights to show that you could take the pain, and then people would leave you alone.
Well, apparently, as a distinct ethnic group, our threshold of pain and tolerance has not been reached yet. I don't know how much more we can endure before it literally does come to where we're just falling on our swords and killing ourselves to satisfy the lust for diversity that this country has apparently developed. Because there's one and only one reason that people are moving out of the cities and enduring these brutally long commutes. And whether or not people will be honest and frank about why they are doing this to themselves, well, I guess we'd have to ask them and see. Maybe have to ask them behind the confines of their living room doors, because I don't know if they'd be willing and candid enough to make mention of the fact publicly. But, unfortunately, Sam, it seems as though as long as these folks have entertainment, as long as they have cable TV to wash over themselves during the weekends, and as long as they can scrape by enough of a living to make ends meet barely, they're not going to rock the boat, and they're not going to stand up for what's in their best interest. And I think that whites are the only group in the world that is foolish enough to do this. It's one, out of all of our many, many strengths, this is one very big weakness.
Well, I can't really argue about that, but it wasn't always so, and it doesn't have to always be so. We see in history there come times when there are these great psychological changes that we can't really quite understand.
Sam, just I don't mean to interrupt. Hold that thought, my friend. The break snuck up on me there. I got too enthralled in the conversation. We're going to take that break. We're going to come back and let you pick up your thought right where you left off.
If you knew Peggy Sue, then don't go away. The Political Cesspool guys will be back right after these messages. Peggy Sue. Get on the show and express your opinion in the political cesspool. Call us toll free at 1-866-986-6397. We gotta get
out of this place. Welcome back to the show as we continue on with our good friend Sam Dixon Esquire. I'm going to toss it over to Bill now, who is chomping at the bit to weigh in on the scales in our discussion this evening. Bill, take it away.
Well, Sam, as we were discussing during the break, I think that we can accurately describe white Americans as being domestic refugees in our own country. That is, whites continually try to flee the problems created by the joys of diversity and multiculturalism and flee to places where they can feel safe, where they can cooperate. Unfortunately, when we're followed by minorities seeking the life that we provide, seeking a higher standard of living, our altruism takes over, and we allow them to intrude into the communities that we have built and allow them to essentially take over the best fruits. Do you feel like that we have sort of become the barbarians in the eyes of the government, and that our only solution, and to use your own words, is to abjure the realm, to reject the government and the, I guess you would say, the mainstream or conventional view of how we should live in this country?
Well, I think it's been, if you look at it, the facts straight on, the white Christian core of the United States, the founding stock of this country, has been regarded with active dislike by the establishment and by the establishment's government for generations now. There was some Republican congressman who wrote a book called Harvard Hates America, and it isn't just Harvard. The academics of all, the chairman of the departments and the majority of academics at virtually every college in America hate America, and the government hates America, at least what we think of as America. And yes, I think one of the critical things that has to happen, speaking of the psychological issues, is that white Christian Americans, the native founding stock, have got to disconnect from the government. They have got to learn to distinguish between our people and the government that runs the country. They still seem, most of them have some idea that the president's our president, and that Condoleezza Rice was our Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton is our Secretary of State. You know, that's not been the case now for generations. If you try to think of anything this government has done to benefit us, but for generations now, I can't think of anything. They have been waging war, school busing, immigration policies, taxation policies, conducting a vicious psychological warfare and abuse of children in the school systems with their biased histories and all of this. These people are not our friends, and they're not our friends. And white Americans have to learn to look at the federal government the way Poles looked at the satellite, collaborationist government that the Soviets put in charge of Poland from 1945 to the time it was toppled around 1990. And when people come to view it as Obama is their president, Hillary Clinton is their Secretary of State, and these people are foreign to us, then maybe they'll start doing something. Maybe they will certainly be a lot better off than we are now, in which the people who are most hated and despised and persecuted by the government are the ones who rush out to put up the federal flags and support the war in Iraq and back President Bush and this kind of thing. These people have got to come to recognize that this government, even when it's run by Republicans like Bush or if McCain had won, McCain is not their government. It's not their friend.
Well, Sam, you mentioned that a lot of our people are in psychological straitjackets. It's all well and good if anyone wants to go out there and join a club to restore a house. And this is basically a lot of the things we talked about last night. I guess this entire interview is, in fact, a recap of the meeting we had last night for those who couldn't be there. But it's all well and good if someone wants to join a restoration society. It's all well and good if someone wants to join an organization to save a plant that we've never heard of, or an obscure animal, or feed the kids in some third world country, which is all well and good, and there's nothing wrong with any of that. But if anyone should dare speak up and say, listen, I have a vested interest in safeguarding the rights and heritage of European Americans, not only is that not a worthy cause, but it is in fact sinful or evil, you will be told. And Sam, you brought up a good point last night about how our people attend thousands of meetings a day to help everyone but themselves. I'd like for you to retell that story, if you don't mind.
Well, it goes into what Bill Rowland was saying about how we try to create our own communities, and then we invite other people in and turn our communities over to people who are in competition with us for space and resources. As this day dawned and the planet turned on its axis, all over the white world, in Russia, Europe, America, Canada, there literally were thousands and maybe tens of thousands of meetings in which whites gathered to discuss how they could benefit non-whites or Jews or other people, anybody but themselves. If that seems like a very high number, you need to rethink that. I mean, you think of all the Optimist clubs and Kiwanis clubs and Rotary clubs and PTA meetings and Ladies of the Church meetings and Diversity Board meetings. Literally, it was tens of thousands all over the white world of whites trying to meet and come up with proposals that would benefit African Americans in the ghetto, blacks in Africa, Latin Americans who come to America, Latin Americans in Latin America, indigenous peoples in the jungles of Brazil, yellow people, Israel. This sort of thing. On the same day, there was not one single meeting anywhere on the planet in which yellow people, black people, or Jewish people, or Hispanic people gathered and had a meeting on how can we best help white Christians. But was there a meeting in a synagogue anywhere in the world where Jews met to discuss this? Did any black group have a meeting on how we can best help white people? Now, if you raise this issue with them, as I have, they're very clever and witty, and they come back and say, oh, we did have a meeting. We discussed how to help white people overcome their racism and give us more money. That's their idea of helping us. But anybody can see through this. Well, regardless of what one's opinion of altruism is, this has to be this sharp distinction between not one single meeting anywhere on the globe of anyone trying to help a little blonde-haired Johnny who's on his way to the Baptist church in Alabama, and yet tens of thousands of how to help the blacks in Darfur and how to help this group and that group and the other group. If white liberals and altruists are thoughtful, they ought to be concerned by the fact that it doesn't seem to be an iota of altruism among any other race on Earth except their own. I mean, this is a very startling thing. And as I was saying, there was not one meeting of them to discuss how to help whites. There were probably precious few meetings, like the one we held last night, in which whites gathered together to talk in adult and serious tones and sensible, restrained tones about what can be done to salvage the legitimate interests of our group.
You know, we have such misplaced sympathies, not as if there's anything wrong with helping anyone else, but as you've said so many times before, including in appearances on this program in the past, Sam, as the Greeks said, all things in moderation, our virtues, when we carry them to the extreme, as we do, and as we have continued to do, are certainly hurting our posterity. They're hurting our children. And, people need to to just unshackle themselves and say, you know what, we're going to, just as everyone else wants to better their lot in lives, we as European Americans or as Germans or Irish or what have you, any of our derivatives, we want to make sure that our interests are safeguarded as well. But as you mentioned, Sam, until we can grow up and talk about these issues and have society debate these issues in the court of public opinion, we're going to be at a very stark competitive disadvantage. If someone goes to their local congressman's town hall meeting and says, Mr. Congressman, what have you done to help the interests of European Americans in your term? What would happen to that guy, Sam?
Oh, he would be, they would probably have the guards take him out. He'd be booed and hissed by the people in attendance, even if it were a Republican conservative congressman. The only morally acceptable position on this issue is that the white race must be exterminated. And that seems crazy or goofy. Think again. You know, if it is immoral per se, if it is immoral from the very get-go to be concerned about the survival of the white race, then what the establishment, what the diversity boards, what these people are telling us is the only policy the establishment will tolerate.
Sam, we got a break. I'm sorry, we're going to pick it up right there. Stay tuned, everybody. We're back in just a second.
Don't go away. The Political Cesspool guys will be back right after these messages.
We gotta get out of this place. If it's the last thing we ever do, we gotta get out of this place. Girl, there's a better life for me.
If I didn't tell her, I didn't. Welcome back. To get on the Political Cesspool, call us on James's Dime, toll-free at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the Political Cesspool, James Edwards.
Continuing on with our absolutely riveting and engrossing discussion with Sam Dixon, our final guest of the evening. Welcome back to the program. Sam, before that last break, we were talking about the absolute blatant and egregious double standards that are in play. It seems as though every issue, every species on the face of the planet is entitled to defense unless you are, God forbid, a Caucasian, and particularly a German or a white Southern Christian. You're really in trouble then. But Sam, you know, if we say, listen, something's wrong here. Yes, we don't mind everyone else wanting to defend that which is theirs and defend their pride and heroes and cultural heritage. But we ought to be able to do that too. If we said that, we are immediately shouted down as racists, as white supremacists, or even as violent terrorists. And whether or not our people know that this is absolutely killing us, our enemies do. And you mentioned, you shared with us a story last night about a warlord in Haiti, and I'd like for you to share that with the audience, if you don't mind.
When the Haitians revolted against the French rule in 1791, the initial leader was a guy named Toussaint Louverture, who eventually was taken away to France and died there. And his place was taken by one named Jean-Jacques Dessalines, for whom the current Haitian national anthem is named. Jean-Jacques Dessalines presided over a genocide of whites in Haiti. And he went in. He declared independence on January 1 of 1804. And about that time, when he declared independence, he said he would like to write independence with a pen filled with white blood and drink a toast out of a white skull. And he told his people, to his generals and others, to massacre every white on the island, and they carried that out. And some of the blacks were concerned about the mulattoes were concerned about how white might react to that. That, you know, they had the United States to their northwest, and they had the British colonies or in the Caribbean, and that these white countries might react to a genocide of white people. And Jean-Jacques Dessalines, genocidal black, told the other blacks, "You don't understand what the white man is like. He's not like black men. He has no sense of identity. He doesn't identify with his own." He didn't use those terms, but he said, "If I were to take a white man down to the customs office here in Port-au-Prince, if I were to hang the white man from one side of the scale and put a big couple hundred pound sack of coffee on the other side of the scale, He said the whites, like these British and Americans you're worried about, they would come and negotiate over the buying of the sack of coffee and completely ignore the whites squirming on the edge of the rope, in the end of the rope, on the other side of the scales. And so that's what a very shrewd hater of our race, a practitioner of genocide, said in 1804. And you draw the line from there, and you read the New York Times yesterday, and you see no mention of the genocidal policies in Zimbabwe against the white minority there, which has caused this famine. And so, you know, when you see the refusal to report things like this, this makes these people accomplices to it.
Well, Sam, and to hear you say that, you know, it seems as though that would spur people to take action. And unfortunately, if our people want to get really radical, it seems that their solution is to join the Republican Party and vote for a guy, like you've said, jumped up white trash Connecticut scallywag George Bush. I mean, that's how our people believe that they're really sticking it to the man. And that's how they're going to take their country back, if they are even politically active at all, which most of our people aren't. And certainly our people aren't very active in anything of positive substance. But, you know, I say again, you know, there's no hatred in my heart, nothing but love. I have dreams. I share the same ambitions to be a positive member of society. And I have a wife. I want to have a family. But I cannot in good conscience see what is happening to my extended family, our race, Sam, and not try to do something, not use this radio program, this tool that's you know, we've had here at our disposal to do something about it. I just wish more would follow our lead, follow your lead. Maybe things could turn around. And I know we've been lamenting a lot of the sobering realities that we're faced with, but before the sand falls from the hourglass tonight and we're out of time, I want to try to end this interview on a more positive and uplifting note. And with that being said, I want to turn it over to Bill.
Well, Sam, I think the altruism among our people is a double-edged sword. Obviously, we give our charity and our love and concern to the wrong people very often. But I think you'll have to agree that there is a certain persistent anxiety among non-whites that this largesse and this generosity will be withdrawn. You know, when I had I started this show talking about my car wreck, and I brought it up a couple times, and I ended talking about my car wreck. When I went off in this ditch, I was on a dirt road, a pretty isolated place. And the first thing I noticed was a farmer had come out of his field with his tractor to help, you know. And the first thing he said is, "I can pull your car out. Don't worry about your car. Is everybody okay?" And then someone comes up from the dirt road from, I couldn't even see their house from the other direction, and stops and says, "Is there anything we can do? Can we bring you water, whatever?" I had friends in front of me and friends behind me, and they stopped. And, you know, tonight I have a place to stay. I have offers of a car to drive back home if I need it. So our altruism works in our favor when we just close the gap between ourselves a little bit. And, you know, my challenge out there to all my fellow European Americans is take one day out of the year to help somebody of your own race. And that is not going to deprive anything to or from people who are not of your race. So if you spend most of your time sending charity to Africa or to Indonesia or to some foreign country trying to bail out the what I call the bottomless pit of despair in non-white nations, take one day or $1 and spend it on somebody of your own race to help them. It feels just as good and sometimes better. So, I mean, that's the step I can see taking the right direction is to at least revive this idea that we're worth one day a year. What do you think, Sam?
Well, I think that's nice, but I think they also need to go way beyond that and support people who are out like James Edwards, who are on the cutting edge and taking the fire and doing this kind of, and really fighting for their survival. If they would give a significant contribution to political candidates like David Duke or a show like Political Cesspool, $100 a year. This would repay them many times over in terms of changing the policies that make them have to drive these commutes, make them have to put their kids in private schools, policies that are costing them thousands of dollars a year. They could all be changed if they would show the same degree of support for their community that minority groups show for their community.
Sam, you write in the most current edition of the Occidental Quarterly a very moving passage, and I'd like to share it in closing this evening. You say that, and I quote, "I believe no matter how dark this night is, no matter how much we're bullied and are threatened, no matter how much we feel that we are marginalized, no matter how much we see that the resources available to our enemies who desire the extinction of our race exceed our own, that our race will not end with a whimper. It will not end, but will triumph. We really have no reason to believe at this time that that will in fact happen. But do you still maintain the hope, Sam? Because I do.
Well, I have every reason to believe it will happen. All that it would take for it to stop, for what we are concerned about to be stopped, would be for whites to get up tomorrow and decide that they're going to run their homelands again. That's all it takes. Without the racial rank breakers in our own community, our enemies would not have a chance. Without the Hillary Clintons and the others who go and tempt for these people and advocate these very dissimilar policies of praising Jewish nationalism in Israel and then getting up at the Methodist Church next Sunday and ranting and raving about how much she hates it among her own people. Without people like Hillary and Margaret Mead and Eleanor Roosevelt and Earl Warren and people like this, our enemies would not have a chance. As we've said many times, you know, we don't have a Jewish problem. We don't have a black problem. We have a white liberal problem.
Well, Sam, the only other problem we have tonight is that we're out of time. And I tell you, an hour with you goes by far too quickly. I want to thank you again for being on the program tonight and for being a friend. I tell you, I think the world of you, and I look forward to our next meeting.
Great. I feel the same way. Good night. Thanks.
Good night, Sam Dixon. And, Bill, it's been a great debut here on Liberty News Radio Network. We've got some great guests, some elected officials coming up your way. Confederate History Month is coming up in April. A lot more to come on the political cesspool as we continue on well into now our fifth year of broadcasting excellence of this award-winning program. For Bill Rowland and the rest of the production crew and hosting staff, Eddie the Bombardier Miller and Winston Smith, Art Frith, the rest of the crew here in Memphis, Tennessee and around the country, I am your host, James Edwards. Remember to live life the way we do, without retreat, surrender, or apology. You'll be happy you did. Good night, everybody.
Thanks for joining us tonight in the Political Cesspool. To learn more about us or to make a donation to keep this program on the air, go to www.thepoliticalcesspool.org.